Ulysses and the Beautiful After Kant. Good morning. Today I want to tell you what I've learned about the beautiful as a consequence of our 5 Sunday school lessons on Immanuel Kant. And I want to use as an example my experience with our close reading of Ulysses. And before I begin the speech proper, I want to thank my audience for attending those 5 Sunday school lessons. Your enthusiasm, your friendship, your interest, your loyalty to the project motivated our study of that extraordinarily difficult text. I also want to thank our 8 students of Ulysses, who we have worked since, as I mentioned, November the 29th, 2011, reading, researching, studying, and teaching one another Ulysses. As we learned in 4 Sunday School, Kant says that there are 4 moments or categories of the beautiful, and that they are quality, quantity, relation, and modality. What Kant says is that beauty is experienced as an entirely disinterested satisfaction that is universal, that is purposive without a purpose, and that is necessary. The main idea from Kant is that the beautiful is experienced as a satisfaction. The beautiful is not experienced cognitively through understanding. The beautiful is experienced emotionally through feeling. The beautiful is a certain type of satisfaction. And Kant says that the satisfaction comes from seeing an object and detecting that there is something there not fully understood. Perhaps one way to say this is that there is a certain positive tension that is created in the presence of the object which is deemed ultimately to be beautiful. An example of this experience occurred last Tuesday during our 17th meeting of our close reading of James Joyce's Ulysses. As you may know, James Joyce's Ulysses is regarded by the board of the Modern Library as the number one best novel of all time. Now, as an aside, the 5 best novels of all time, according to the board of the Modern Library, are James Joyce's Ulysses, The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald, A Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce, Lolita by Vladimir Nabokov, and Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. But there are 2 lists by the Modern Library. The first is the board's list, you know, the scholars, and the second is the reader's list. And you may be interested to know the first 5 in the reader's list. And that list includes Atlas Shrugged, number 1, by Ayn Rand. Number 2 is The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand. The next is Battlefield Earth by L. Ron Hubbard. The next is Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien. And number 5 is To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. Ulysses is the number 11 book on the reader's list of the greatest books. Among the books I mentioned there, I am perhaps a little shy to admit that I have not read The Lord of the Rings.
Shame on you.
Our method for studying Ulysses is this. We assign 8 pages, more or less, per reader for extremely close study. Each reader works up his or her section and presents his or her section, as do the other presenters, to the whole group in a teaching session lasting 2 or 2.5 hours. We have 8 readers. Because we have met 17 times and we've just finished 15 chapters. And the reason those 2 numbers don't coincide is because the last chapter was 180 pages long and we had to divide it into 3 60-page segments. We are on page 612 of a 783 book. We are 78% done. As I mentioned, we started our study in November 29th, 2011, and we will finish in May, July, September of 2015 this year. The project will have lasted 3 years and 10 months if we are finished as scheduled. Now, Ulysses is regarded as the number one best novel of all time because it is beautiful according to the criteria of Immanuel Kant. And this is how that goes. The reading of James Joyce's of Ulysses is very difficult because there are so many puzzles in the text. One of our study aids is a 641-page book of footnotes, 641-page book of footnotes called Ulysses Annotated by Don Gifford. James Joyce famously said that I put in so many enigmas and puzzles that it will keep the professors busy for centuries arguing over what I meant. And that's the only way of ensuring one's immortality. Now, we finished the climax of the book on Tuesday last. The climax, pun intended, of the book occurs in the red light district of Dublin, Ireland, called Nighttown. In my little 10-page section, Stephen Dedalus, who is a main character, he's been knocked out by a British soldier in a drunken fight over a girl. He mumbles a few words. Who? Drive. Fergus now. And Pierce. Woods woven shade. That is a puzzle, one of hundreds of puzzles in the book. The other main character, Leopold Bloom, misunderstands this reference, totally misinterprets it. But a Google search of Fergus Now or Woods Woven Shade will reveal that Stephen Dedalus is attempting to quote, in his stupor, a poem by William Butler Yeats, 1865-1939. And the poem is entitled, Who Goes with Fergus? Now, Fergus is a Celtic mythological king from the 3rd century AD, and here is the very brief poem by Yeats. Who will drive with Fergus now, and pierce the deep wood's woven shade, and dance upon the level shore? Young man, lift up your russet brow, and lift your tender eyelids, maid, and brood on hopes and fear no more, and no more turn aside and brood upon love's bitter mystery. For Fergus rules the brazen cars, and rules the shadows of the wood, and the white breasts of the dim sea, and all disheveled wandering stars. The poem calls on the young man and the maiden to stop brooding about love's bitter mystery and to turn to nature and the mythic past. This poem is a key to the whole book. It's a clue, and it has a higher meaning. And it happens that we think we have got at least a partial solution to the puzzle. Here is what the meaning of it is in the context of the book. The central action of Ulysses is Leopold Bloom's day-long torment about his wife Molly's tryst with her music producer Blazes Boyland to occur at 4 p.m. of the day of the book, Thursday, June the 16th, 1904. Love's bitter mystery, which is in the poem, is present in the emotional turmoil of Leopold Bloom depicted in the entire novel. That's one part of the solution. The poet William Butler Yeats was born in Sandymount, Dublin, Ireland. Ulysses begins at the Martello Tower in Sandymount. That's another element which is part of the solution to the problem. W.B. Lake Yeats was in love with a woman named Maud Gonne. All this is discovered by Google. Maud lost a one-year-old child. Maud asked that she be buried with the baby shoes of her infant child. Now, Maud was an heiress, and she buried her son in a mausoleum purchased with her inheritance. After the child's death and burial, she met with her husband, from whom she was separated, at the child's mausoleum. They had intercourse beside the child's coffin, hoping that by metempsychosis, the soul of the dead child would transfer to the newly conceived embryo. Now, this is not fiction. I'm not giving you fiction. I'm telling you what really happened to the friend of William Butler Yeats. Now, metempsychosis means the metempsychosis means the transmigration of the soul from one body to another. Metempsychosis is a major theme of Ulysses, and it comes up for the first time in chapter 4 of 18 chapters. Maud Gonne's Real life suffering at the loss of her son parallels the fictional loss of his 11-year-old Dale son by Leopold Bloom, another major theme of Ulysses. So what my point here is that, you know, as a reader, you see these six random words, and what you might conclude is that has some meaning. Now it happens, and it has some higher meaning. As it happens, we were able to discover the higher meaning. But it is this experience, that is, you see something in the work and you say there must be some higher meaning there. This is the experience, this excitement that you feel about detecting the higher meaning, which is, according to Kant, the experience of the beautiful. There are hundreds of puzzles like this in Ulysses, and this particular puzzle is of importance. It is the tension of the impending discovery of the higher meaning of the work of art or literature that is the satisfaction that signals the beautiful. So it's the tension of the impending discovery of higher meaning in the work of art or literature that is the satisfaction that signals the beautiful. This is what we've learned from Kant. This is what he says. The tension might be described as a spiritual place between the mundane and the divine. Now, perhaps I go on great dangerous ground here when I talk about the words like spiritual and divine. Spiritual simply means of or pertaining to consciousness. Divine means godlike. For a eudaimonist, godlike simply refers to that which is marvelous or amazing or awesome or presently and perhaps always beyond our capacity to understand. The mundane is our workaday world. There's no mystery. We are simply performing common tasks with our common skills under no stress, particular stress, and no bother. Nothing unusual is happening in the mundane world. Imagine moving laundry from the washer to the dryer, or imagine vacuuming the living room, or approving a routine work document after a review. These are mundane tasks. That is our mundane world. The divine is not accessible to us generally, and perhaps never. The divine is an anticipated place, a suspected place, a hoped-for place. Perhaps it is precisely that to which Kant refers when he talks about our sensing of a higher as yet undiscovered purpose. We talked about purposefulness without a purpose when we were looking at Kant. The suspicion that there is some higher meaning in art or literature, the positive feeling in the presence of that recognition, is the satisfaction identified by Kant as the beautiful. Expressions such as "that performance was divine" convey this thought. Now, metaphors for that place between the mundane and the divine abound and are often the very subject of art. That is, there's a place between the mundane and the divine. And that's where art pulls us up. It pulls us up from the mundane into an intermediate place between the mundane workaday world and this imagined divine world. What is that place? Here is a passage from The Golden Compass by Philip Pullman. This is a Child's series of books. At that moment he fell still. The vault of heaven, star-studded, profound, was pierced as if by a spear. A jet of light, a jet of pure energy released like an arrow from a great bow, shot upward from the spot where Lord Asriel had joined the wire to Roger's daemon. The sheets of light and color that were the aurora tore apart. A great rending, grinding, crunching, tearing sound reached from one end of the universe to the other. There was dry land in the sky, sunlight. In this scene, the mundane world is the cold Arctic tundra. Of special science of the book, a doorway to another dimension is ripped open, and the heroine Lyra will shortly climb through it. Quoting the final words of the book, "So Lyra and her daemon turned away from the world they were born in and looked toward the sun and walked into the sky." Lyra moves from the mundane world into the divine world in this fictional representation of the movement from the mundane to the divine. Now, we're currently reading Dr. Faustus by Thomas Mann. Now, this book is similar to Ulysses in that its references are many and the layers of meaning are many. The experience of reading draws the reader from the mundane toward the higher realm, toward the divine. Or if you like, it's some higher, though not yet detected, higher meaning. And I'm using divine as a metaphor, please. We know that there is a higher meaning there. We do just not yet understand it. We had the same experience with the other Thomas Mann books we've read, Death in Venice, The Magic Mountain, and Joseph and His Brothers. There is a higher meaning to be detected beyond the simple storyline. There is an actual feeling associated with the lifting from the mundane toward the divine by great art and literature. Sometimes, as in the Golden Compass, the lifting is visually expressed in the art. The mundane is down here. The divine is up there. Somehow the observer is suspended between the down here and the not accessible up there. We recently enjoyed the film Interstellar, Matthew McConaughey as Cooper. There's a mysterious poltergeist in the story. There are strange and difficult to translate communications from somewhere. There are powerful feelings between man and woman and father and daughter, love's bitter mystery. There is a great visual rendering of a tesseract. A tesseract is a four-dimensional analog to a cube. A five-dimensional world in this movie is trying to communicate with the four-dimensional world of the hero using this tesseract. Cooper finds himself suspended between the mundane world that he can see and with great difficulty can communicate through the tesseract and the divine world of the unknown but certainly detective five-world reality which is trying to influence the circumstances. Interstellar is a beautiful film according to the criteria of Kant. Music can provide a similar experience of lifting one from the mundane world toward the divine. Sometimes in forum as a whole, and sometimes in oratory in particular, we experience a lifting from the mundane toward the divine. President Mandy's self-analysis and Frank's commentary on Mandy's self-analysis are recent examples of the lifting from the mundane toward the divine that we have experienced. Great architecture achieves the elevating effect.
Outside, Ellen. Outside, Ellen.
Ellen, go outside. Okay, fine.
Great architecture achieves the elevating effect from the mundane toward the divine. The ceiling of the cathedral at Chartres is 120 feet from the floor. The effect is to draw the visitor up from the floor, from the mundane, to the ceiling toward the divine. The place is infused with beauty and is surrounded by beauty. Likewise, the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C. has a height of 129 feet. It is a beautiful space. You are elevated toward concepts of freedom by the images within the monument. Painting frequently pictures a mundane setting in a divine context. Sierra Nevada Morning, which is by Albert Bierstadt, pictures some deer by a lake. Below a mountain range dressed in sunbeams, there's a painting, Hardanger Fjord, by a Norwegian painter, Hans Gude, that pictures a man and his toddler son walking their dog to the water's edge with the fjord in the background, with sunbeams streaming down through cumulus clouds over towering mountains. From the mundane to the divine we are drawn. Thomas Cole, an American artist, is the founder of the Hudson River School of Art. This art group was influenced by Romanticism, and they did lots of landscapes and wilderness pictures. If you're familiar with Thomas's Cole sequence of painting called The Course of Empire, five paintings, The Savage State, The Arcadian or Pastoral State, The Consummation of Empire, Destruction and Desolation are fabulous movements from the mundane to the divine. Painting, architecture, dance, music, and literature are all sources of beauty. They move us from the mundane toward the divine. We had a marvelous discussion one day at Forerunners about it. It is a special something that infuses a work of art or a performer, rendering it, the performer, somehow special. The it is identical with Thomas Aquinas' idea of radiance. According to Thomas Aquinas, the four components of beauty are wholeness, harmony, and radiance. The it is also identical with Thomas Immanuel Kant's idea of spirit, expressed in this passage, which I'm going to read from section 49 of the Critique of Judgment. And this Critique of Judgment is the book we did in five sequences of Sunday school. Here's the quote. "We say of certain products of which we expect that they should at least in part appear as beautiful art, that they are without spirit, though we find nothing to blame in them on the score of taste. A poem may be very neat and elegant, but without spirit. A history may be exact and well arranged, but without spirit. A festal discourse may be solid and at the same time elaborate, but without spirit. Conversation is often not devoid of entertainment, but without spirit. Even of a woman, we may say she is pretty, an agreeable talker, and courteous, but without spirit. What then do we mean by spirit? Spirit is, in an aesthetical sense," this is Kant, "is the name given to the animating principle of the mind. Radiance, it, and spirit might be described as the presence of the divine within the work of art or within the performer." Now, let us admit that we're talking about art feelings, and that communication concerning any feelings, including art feelings, is difficult. One has to have been there, done that. We can only recall the experience to another who has had the experience. Now, we've talked about this before. There are categories of experience that cannot be shared. The experience of pregnancy cannot be shared with a man. The experience of love cannot be shared with a person who has never experienced love. And the experience of parenthood cannot be shared with a person who has never been a parent. Now, my hope in this talk today is to signal to those who do not understand that there is something here worthy of experiencing and understanding. In 1987, I saw the film Moonstruck, starring Cher and Nicolas Cage. The movie played the music from Puccini's La Bohème. And they show an actual scene from a Met opera production, Franco Zeffirelli's production of the La Bohème is in the film. It's the scene at the Paris Gatehouse in the snow between Mimi and Rodolfo. I saw that these fictional characters thought that there was something there in the opera. And I made a silent promise to myself at that time that to find that something someday. It took me almost 20 years to get it. But now I get it. So, we have said today thank you to our four Sunday school attendees for participating in our discussion about Kant on beauty. I have said thank you to our eight intrepid students of James Joyce's Ulysses for our soon-to-be four-year adventure in close reading. We have suggested that Kant's insight into the beautiful is that beautiful is precisely the satisfaction one experiences when a meaning or purpose is detected in a work of art, though not yet specifically identified. I've given an example from our study of Ulysses. We discovered and unpacked a clue to the meaning of the whole novel in the Yeats poem, Who Goes with Fergus. The key reveals that a major theme of Ulysses is love, and that the events in the life of James Joyce's poet's hero, in the events in the life of William Butler Yeats, the hero of James Joyce, are echoed in key elements in the novel, giving an entire understanding, or helps understand what the novel's doing. We learned that when a clue is unpacked or the puzzle solved, the satisfaction in the work of art remains great. We have suggested that the shift from the mundane toward the divine is related to, if not identical with, the Kant idea that satisfaction one feels in the presence of the beautiful is the recognition of meaning or purpose beyond that which is immediately observable to us on first reading. I want to come up with a name for the place that great art takes us. Interstellar is perhaps a candidate, though ultimately unsatisfactory because it limits us to science fiction or science. The feeling we experience in the Jefferson Memorial cannot be called interstellar. It doesn't work. We can say for certain that we would like to, from time to time, to rise above the mundane and toward the divine. Perhaps what we call the place is not important. It is important that we get there now and then. Having a name for that place, though, would be useful for sharing the experience or evoking the experience in those who have had it. Let's work on naming the place between the mundane and the divine, shall we? Thank you all.
Thank you.